Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hang in. Dude, there it is.
Smiley Kaufman for 61.
Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
What's up, y'all? I am really excited to share this next conversation with you. Not only is my guest one of the best tennis pros of the early 2000s, he is absolutely dominating the celebrity golf circuit these days. And maybe the best amateur player I've been paired with in a pro-am, Marty Fish. Marty and I talk a little golf, but most importantly, we get into the mental health adversity that each of us face as pros in our respective sports. My hope is that the vulnerability Marty shows in speaking about what he's been through might provide some sort of comfort for any of you fighting through that same battle. So here it is, my chat with Marty Fish. All right, we have Marty Fish joining us on The Smiley Show. Marty, good friend of mine. We played some golf together, known him from the golf course at Madison Club, first time we played together. And man, I tell you what, I think you're probably the best amateur I've ever played with, and thank goodness you were playing a scramble that day, because I was a little concerned that you probably would have beat me best ball. But played with Mike Melman, JJ, the boys out there. Remember that day much or no?
I do. No, it wasn't at Madison. It was at you were playing in a tournament. It was in Vegas. You were playing in the event, and we came and played the pro-am.
You're so right. I don't know why. I just had Mike and JJ,
and it was like the three of us and you.
You're so right, because they did that snake trick on like 17.
Yeah, you would forget. I wouldn't. You know, I mean, you'd forget about playing with three hacks, and I wouldn't forget about playing with a professional golfer who had been a PGA Tour winner and all that stuff. And like, I don't play very many like pro-ams, you know, like on the course the day before a tournament. So I remember,
and it was, I'm sure you Madison. Do.
I would have loved it to be at Madison. I love Madison Club and all that. And I'd be happy to play golf with you at Madison too. But no, Mikey flew us over on the Casamigos jet or the Discovery jet or whatever it was, and JJ in tow as always. And it was at Summerlin, TPC Summerlin.
You're 100% right. You could see why I would have thought we were playing at a Discovery property. The fact that we were playing with Mike and JJ and got the Casamigos crew, it's just normal to think that we're at a Discovery property. I thought it was the reason why I thought, because typically it, you know, we all go play at Madison Club the week of the American Express tournament. So it just, in my head, I was thinking we'd played out there. Maybe we did play out there once. I don't know.
I'm sure we did. I'm sure we hung out there for sure, but no, dude, that was, I'll never forget that. I mean, like I've only played one other, well, that's not true. I got to play in a, PGA Tour event. And so I played in the pro-am for that. They made me work for that. The 3M.
So I'm a brag, man.
Multiple pro-ams in that tournament. But dude, I've only played in two of them. And I played with you, I played with Xander, and I played with Harry English. And so I remember all of them, and they were super fun.
Well, that's a great crew of dudes there, man. That's can't pick them any better than that. Well, you obviously world-class tennis player, but you know, golf is a big part of your life now as you move forward and in what you do. And I really want to kind of start there. Where did you start playing the game of golf at a pretty early age?
Yeah, I played when I was born. My mom tied a string. I was born in Minnesota, and my mom, we had a basement. My mom tied a string to the ceiling and, you know, brought it down to my level where I could basically just when I could stand. And she put like a baseball bat and a golf club and a tennis racket kind of next to each other. And she tied a string in, a ball to the end of it, a wiffle ball, a tennis ball, whatever it was. And so I'd grab whatever club was next to me or whatever racket or whatever, and I'd swing it, and I'd swing everything from the same side. It was a righty tennis backhand or a lefty baseball swing and a lefty golf swing. And so it was all the same side. And so I developed really good. I did it for my son as well, because I developed like really good hand-eye coordination from I think from even, you know, an early age, stuff like that. And so it's always felt really natural for me to swing from that side. And then ultimately in tennis, by far my best shot was my two-hand and backhand. And I could sort of time the ball in baseball, what little baseball I played up until, 13 or 14 years old. And then obviously golf. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why golf comes pretty naturally or easily for me is because I just learned at such a young age that muscle memory so early on, like a language, right? I mean, you learn a language when you're, an infant, and it's, infinitely much easier than it is learning a language when you're 30 years old, right? So it's just natural for them. So I don't, I've never really taken any lessons or anything in golf, and don't really know why things happen, but I know that I can sort of get the club to where I think it should be. We were talking before we started this about like putting. Like, I have no idea how to putt, but like, I don't know why things happen. That's the frustrating thing for me, is like I've become friends with lots of LPGA players and PGA players. And sometimes I'll ask, like, Nelly, for instance, and I'll say, I'll see her on Instagram or something, and I'll write her a message and I'll go, hey, do you like, she's got like some, video that she put on and putting, hit a putt in a tournament or something like that. And it looks like ever so slightly, she's hitting like almost topspin on the putt, right? Like, she's hitting like sort of up on it. And so I write her and I go, hey, are you hitting up on the ball? Like putting like topspin, like a topspin forehand kind of thing, like on your putts. And she's like, she's wrote back one dimple up or something like that. Like one dimple from the middle. And so it meaning that, like, yes, she puts like a little bit of spin on it. Like, I have no idea. My putts just slot. They slice. They're like little sidewinder slices. So I can't figure it out. I can't figure any of the putting out. But the actual ball striking and stuff like that, I don't know why, for some reason, and I don't play very often, but there's not a lot going on in my head, which is a good thing in golf, I think.
Yeah, it is. It 100% is.
Yeah.
And you know, my DMs are open as well. If you ever want to ask me how I hit my putts,
she put, first of all, I did ask you about the perfect stroke thing or whatever that putting green is.
Yeah.
Called
that perfect putting mat. Yeah. I love
perfect
it.
Perfect putting mat. So I got one of those, and I feel like, I don't know if they're accurate or if they're like cheating or what. And you said you used it to like to practice. So I'm gonna use it more.
Get it down, man. Send me some videos.
I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I'm hitting like these little slappy putts, and every single round of golf that I play, I have either a new putter or a new putting stance. So it's pretty frustrating.
Well, you talked about, studying the mental game, and really enjoyed the Netflix documentary that you were a part of. If you haven't watched it yet, it's called Untold Breaking Point. It's on Netflix. I've watched it probably more times than I can count, because it's so relatable to the same experience I felt like I had when I was playing golf and kind of struggling. In the documentary, for a large part, it covers your struggles with mental health. And, we've kind of been through it both ourselves. I actually experienced it once in Colonial, even on one of my best years. I had no idea what was going on, and I've never been able to understand where it came from. And it was my first dose of a trigger that I've never experienced before on the golf course. And when was the first time you've kind of noticed that sign of the mental health struggle that kind of creeped into your career?
Yeah, it's I appreciate you watching it. First of all, I know we've spoken in private about, kind of how we felt, or, text message here or there or something. But yeah, I mean, look, as athletes, we're trained to never show fear, never show weakness, right? Like, I played a sport where it was just a one-on-one game, non-contact, one-on-one, leave the locker room, you're all by yourself, just figure it out. And like, if you can't figure it out, it's on you. It's not on anyone else. And so it can be pretty daunting to leave the locker room and you go out there and you're like, you got to problem solve and, you know, and beat this person. There's a lot of people watching and there's a lot of pressure and you got, you know, a lot of background noise and all that stuff, right? With sponsors and family and coaches and trainers and all that, you know, all that stuff. So there's a lot of mouths to feed and a lot of, you know, we're always trained to not show struggle. To answer your question on the anxiety stuff and when that sort of came, that was 2012. 2012 was the type of year for me. I had my best year in 2011, best year of my career. I had won a bunch of tournaments and finished in the top 10, made the World Tour final for the first and only time in my career. And I played really late into that season. I played my last match against Federer on Thanksgiving Day in London, in the World Tour final there. And then I left to go down to Perth, Australia, like December 28th. So like I had 4 weeks off basically, or, you know, just kind of a little over 4 weeks off, in our off season, usually. And every other off season we've always had, I've always had, you know, ended at, in October, late October, something like that. Yeah. So I've always had 2 months, you know, kind of two months, maybe even more. This time I didn't have much time, and it was the highest that I had ever finished, sort of in the top eight, and got to seventh in the ranking was the highest that I was able to get to. And that,
you know, I mean, it's so impressive though.
I think it deserves a little bit of context when I'm talking about like rankings, when I did it, because there are, look, that was a year that Federer, Nadal, Djokovic and Murray, Andy Murray were completely dominating the sport. They were making the semis of every major. They were making the semis of every Masters event. So like, if you wanted to make the World Tour final, which only had eight people, there were really four spots. Like, honestly, there were four spots. They were so incredibly dominant. And they were just hoarding tournaments, hoarding titles, crazy. And so it was almost like a blessing and a curse, right? To like play in that era, or to kind of peak at that time. Djokovic 2011 was the best player I've ever seen or ever played against. I played against Federer in 2005 on grass and Djokovic in 2011 on like a medium pace hard court were the two best players that I'd ever played against. So in that year I had, you know, the next year I had sort of started, I had a lot of expectations for myself. I had a lot of expectations from others. I was the number one American as well, which was a title that Andy Roddick held for a long time in my career, and did an incredible job of being the alpha male and sort of having to deal with all the press and stress and expectation and all that stuff. And so it was kind of on my shoulders then, and I, you know, I wasn't used to it. So it was a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, and a lot of it was normal, right? Like I just didn't know how to deal with it. Those are the positions and situations you want to be in. And like, I wanted to be in, because I wanted to be the best that I could be. I wanted to be, you know, one of the best players in the world and competing for major championships, competing for big events and playing those guys in big events. And so the expectation and pressure changed for me. And I all of a sudden went to the Australian Open the next year. And, you know, whereas before making the quarterfinals of a major, a round of 16 of a major would be a really awesome achievement. And it is anyways, regardless of how high you're ranked, you know, making the quarterfinals of a, you know, the Australian Open, let's say, is a phenomenal result. And so when I didn't do that in that year, I think I lost in the third round. It was a huge bummer, right? Like it was something that I took hard, that the press was hard. I just didn't know how to deal with it. It was different. And those sort of stresses and expectations changing and things like that really had a major effect on me. Some people it, you know, can handle it or predisposed to handling it. For me, The first time I went, I played a match in Miami, woke up in at 3 a.m. After losing the quarterfinals of that. So there's another sort of event in Key Biscayne that was a tournament that I grew up going to as a fan, right? And so to even play in it was an incredible experience, right? But now I'm, you know, in the top eight in the world, and I'm, you know, just seeded just to go to the quarterfinals. And like, I'm supposed to get to the quarterfinals, and then let's see what you can do from there and see if Fish can get to a higher level than he is now, kind of thing. Right. And I lost in the quarters to a really good player. And like, I walk back into the locker room and I can hear like the announcers as the TV's on in the corner of the locker room, like, pathetic effort from Fish today, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm just like, oh man, like I know I didn't play well, but I tried hard, you know, like and it was just something to where, it was really jarring for me. And I'm the type of person that likes to be liked, right? Like I like to treat people. I've got a lot of friends, I feel like, and like, I like having a lot of friends, if that makes sense. Like I like treating people well, and I like being treated well. Right. And I don't love, you know, when people talk shit about me or whatever, and I'm, you know, and I don't want to put myself in those positions, to, you know, for people to do that. I'm trying to be nice to everyone. Right. And I personally had a hard time dealing with that, dealing with the negative stress, and my, you know, and eventually it came out in an anxiety disorder type format or form. You know, there's panic, there's depression, you know, and you can have all those things can manifest into some pretty bad things, some suicidal thoughts and whatever. And so I was all of the above, you know. I mean, I had a little bit of depression. I certainly had some panic attacks, and I had severe anxiety disorder. And so I was in really bad shape. And, you know, so that first time that I kind of felt it was, you know, March 2020, I'll never forget. I woke up in the middle of the night, thought my heart was just like going to explode. I didn't know anything about it, and was like, you know, beating 220 beats per minute. I worked and trained really diligently. And so I, with a heart rate monitor always when I was, you know, practicing and stuff. So I knew how high I could get my heart rate. I was a really hard worker, later mid to like sort of late stage of my career. I like overturned every stone, you know, I tried every diet or every like thing, you know, to get myself to every pre-workout, every post-work, you know, whatever it was, whatever I put in my body. So I was like really diligent with that stuff. I knew exactly how high I could get my heart rate and then how quickly I could get it down. So that was the way I trained, and I did it every day. And so I could never get my heart rate above 192. So when I would have these sort of panic attacks or anxiety attacks, my heart rate would get to like 220 and 230 beats per minute. And I couldn't physically get my heart to beat that fast on my own. And so I thought something was wrong. And I was, you know, genuinely thought I was dying. Like my heart's going to explode. And like, I can't, you know, and you get those thoughts with anxiety disorder. Anxiety is like, you know, it's really hard to I don't have the vocabulary to like really articulate what anxiety disorder is or like what is anxiety, but like my body is presently here right now, but my mind is like 2 weeks down the road, right?
And
like
it's so like, relatable. Yeah,
what am I doing over there? Why am I thinking about something that's literally 10 days away when I'm right here and I'm not present, right? So like that's anxiety. Getting way down past that, you know, getting way past into the future of, you know, what you're trying to do or what you have to do or what you're going to do. And I still have small issues with that stuff, but working, you know, I work hard on it all the time. And so it's something that will always be a part of my life, but that's something that I have a nice grasp on at the moment.
Yeah, well, I'm with you in that fight. You know, I would say, for me, it's all relatable, everything you just talked about. And the negativity, that's something I like to be like too. And that's was something I've never had. The social media age of just the bullying of not playing well and me trying to prove people wrong that I could play better. But now I'm dealing with performance anxiety on the golf course, where I used to have a pretty good protocol of how to deal with doubts and different thoughts on the golf course that just pop up in your head randomly that you can't control. Anxiety is different.
and you'll have a thousand different thoughts that aren't even close to anywhere near the thoughts that you had and what it did to me. And you talked about how long a round of golf can be. I would get to about the seventh hole and I would be so mentally fatigued from just a mental battle that I was dealing with on the golf course. And so you're talking about the negativity, you're talking about how to handle the doubts and things that come in your mind. And then it leads to, like, even on good years, you know, and you experienced this from 2011, 2012, goal setting. You know, I wasn't ever a great goal setter because it led to expectations that eventually led to some anxiety. And when I was honestly playing my best, I didn't set goals because for me, I just knew I was going to work my tail off and I was going to give it everything I had. And it wouldn't allow me to get too far in front of myself. And I'm kind of curious, did you have any issues with goal setting and when you were playing from 11 to 12?
Yeah, I didn't really set goals. There was a time in 2011 when I, you know, our rankings are same as y'all's, where just a weekly sort of thing. It just updates every week or every Monday, right? And
do y'all's rankings need fixed as well?
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
okay. All those rankings. That's a totally different conversation that we can dive into another day.
The problem with tennis is, like, that is how you are judged. Like, that number next to your name is how you're judged. I feel like with golf, it's a little bit different. Like, they, you know, because there's so many, golf is impossible to follow how people get into tournaments. There's like a gazillion ways that someone could get into an event, whether they have exemptions.
Yeah.
I'm sure you know.
And we don't have a world ranking next to us as a player when we play as well. Like, when I watch a tennis match, I see a number next to a player's name and I automatically think, oh, I guess that's the whatever ranked player in the world or whatever ranked player in that tournament. Is that a good way of looking at a tennis board for the most part?
That's the seeding in the tournament, in that tournament that they're playing in. So, like, you know, someone who doesn't watch a ton of tennis will look at that and go, okay, well, there's Fish and his number is seven. And then there's another guy and he doesn't have a number. They're like, oh, well, he's supposed to win that match. And, like, the guy without the numbers really good too, dude. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I know that.
Yeah. And so, you know, like, that's, you know, that's part of the strip, but that's part of the gig, right? That's part of the gig. So, like, in tennis, like, the only thing that we really have to go on is that number next to your name. And it is just kind of, it doesn't really lie. It's like, it could be a little different if you've been injured or something. You can kind of convince yourself that you're better than the number next to your name. But the highest that I had ever gotten was seven. And it was in 2011. I had finaled in Montreal, and the year before, it's a 12-month ranking system for us instead of 24 months. I wish it was 24 months because we could, you know, 12 months just felt like we were always defending points. Like, every week it sort of felt like it was never ending on defending points to try to keep your ranking up. And a 2-year ranking system, and actually Rafa came around at the end of 2011 to all the guys in the top 10 and tried to get everyone to sign a petition. And I signed it to try and get the ranking system changed. He got all the signatures except for one, the most important one, which is Mr. Federer. So, like, he didn't want it. And so they, you know, and you get an impasse right there. If Nadal and Federer want to do something, it gets done. But if there's a, you know,
kind of sounds like Tiger Woods over on our end of the street,
yeah, one on one side and one on the other, it ain't going to get done. So it remained a 12-month ranking system. Anyways, I got in the locker room that year, that week in Cincinnati, and I looked around and I was like, there's six guys that are in here that are ranked higher than me. That's not good enough. You know? And it was like, I never really stepped back. I never had the time or the chance to kind of step back and go, you know what? Seven in the world is pretty damn good, you know? And, like, I never gave myself that chance. And I never gave myself that chance after the World Tour final in London there in 2011, to kind of go, what a year, you know? Like, what a year. Like, it was, you know, a year you dream about, right? Kind of thing. I played in some really big matches. I beat some really good players, including Nadal and Federer those years, you know, whatever. a lot of good players. And I was never able to, I was never able to step back and kind of go, wow, like great year, dude, like enjoy it, or great week last week or whatever. And kind of sit there, because you just had to, I got there Sunday night and I had to play Tuesday. Like it was wrong. And so, so it was like a, you know, kind of a sort of a blessing and a curse. So my point is I wasn't great at setting goals. And I know some guys are, you know, like I follow, you know, Justin Thomas is obviously really close with you, but a buddy of mine, I guess I could say. And like, I follow him and follow his career. And he said, he's a goal setter, right? Mm-hmm. Like, tells his fans, like what his goals are after the year and stuff. And says what he does well and what he doesn't do well. That works for him. That wouldn't have worked for me, and it didn't work, and it wouldn't have worked for you. So I think like the most important thing to learn from that is like, not everything works for everyone. And you know, on that like kind of mental side of the game, and everyone's really unique. I used to get incredibly nervous before matches, like nights before, mornings of, even lunch that day, hour out, I was a wreck. I couldn't eat. I couldn't, you know, it was hard of forcing food down. If it was a match that three out of five set match and a grand slam, forcing chicken and rice down, I can't eat it. Right. And I'll give you a quick story. I played the first time I made the second week of Wimbledon, which is like a really kind of a milestone, if you will, and with players, because Wimbledon's 2 weeks long, but the middle Sunday they take off. They don't have any play on the middle Sunday. And if you make the second week, you get to hang out that middle Sunday. No one's allowed on the grounds, no fans or anything. So it's like the quietest, best day of the year if you are in that second week of Wimbledon. So I've made the second week of Wimbledon. Then everyone plays the Monday. I played a guy named Tomas Berdych, who had made the final the year before and lost to Nadal in the fourth round that year. I'm getting ready. I'm getting my ankles taped on the one of the training tables down in the training room, and I look over, and my opponent, Tomas Berdych, we're 45 minutes from going on the court. He's sound asleep. He's snoring. And I'm like, there's no way I could do that. I mean, how is that even possible? Right. As soon as they called my name, I felt great. I was like, okay, time to go. And I
was it always that way for you though? Even
I
after
was never nervous. Like obviously I got tight, but like never really nervous to like start a match or anything. It was just the way I was wired. But that guy was, you know, not nervous at all before matches or whatever. He got into the matches and he was super nervous when he got into the matches. So like everyone's really, my point is like, everyone's different. Everyone's unique. Not everyone can prepare like Nadal or warm up like Nadal. They need to, you know, I could never, Rafa warmed up for an hour, like for his match. Like I warmed up for like 15 minutes. I didn't want to waste any energy. Rafa wanted to like get his body going and warm up hours before he played. Everyone's really unique and different. Finding that like that sweet spot of like what you do and what you do well and what makes you comfortable is the most important thing. And it's really hard to find.
So you were able to continue to play tennis with freedom and not experience really any performance anxiety?
I came back in the next year, 2013, in March in Indian Wells was the first tournament that I had played. So I didn't play from September to March the next year. I was pretty nervous during that time, right? Like I was like, okay, is it going to come back? Is it, is my heart okay? I had a heart procedure called tachycardia, which is called, I had an ablation, which is not a heart surgery, but it's a procedure. It's in, you know, they're messing with your heart. So it's like a little uncomfortable, but they fixed it and I was fine. Like physically I was fine. You know, mentally that should have given me the sort of positivity to move forward and like just compete and all that stuff. But I was in such a bad experience with the anxiety disorder that, you know, that if I didn't have the support system that I had, if I didn't find the doctor and get the correct medication to put myself on the right path, there's no telling if I would be here or not. And I truly believe that. I had thoughts of, am I going to be around? Am I going to hurt? Am I going to do something to hurt someone that I love, that's around me, because I'm, you know, in, you know, feeling this way. So I was really nervous in at times when, you know, when I was going through those, you know, those kind of experiences sort of late 2012. And then just over, you know, time heals everything, you know, heals a lot. And I learned from every sort of episode that I had and learned from, you know, the experiences I had, whether it was on an airplane and I'd freak out and have an anxiety attack or something like that. I'd learn from it and try and get better at it, and got to a point where I was really comfortable ending my career in like four or five tournaments, the tournaments that I loved, the tournaments that I felt most comfortable in the United States. So I didn't have to travel very much. And I desperately wanted to end at the US Open, the place that it was all sort of taken away from me. Cause if you remember, I was still in sort of the top 10 in the world at when I had to pull out of the match against Roger in 2012.
You were the number one American.
Yeah, that was a really big match. We had just played the week prior, 2 weeks prior in Cincinnati in a big match. I think in the semis, there was a, you know, really tight match as well. So, you know, I thought I could, you know, thought I could really had a shot to compete with him there. And, you know, it was a big match, you know, my dad's birthday on Labor Day, and, you know, just sort of the match you want to get to, the match you work so hard to get to. Right. And the fact that I couldn't even go out there and play, and that was the only way that I was going to get through it, was, you know, obviously jarring. But I learned from it. I learned from all the episodes and sort of, you know, had the support system, and support system's massive. Being able to talk to people once you get comfortable with your own skin or comfortable being vulnerable was a huge part of it. Just like with loved ones, just sort of saying like, I'm not okay. Like, I am not good. I don't feel good. And, you know, at times it can
be so difficult.
Yeah. It can take a long time for you to get to that point. It can take too long, sometimes for you to get to that point. And I think that's where you see sort of the toughest moments of people, you know, make decisions or whatever, when they're in, you know, like, why did somebody do that? Or why did somebody commit suicide? Or why did somebody do this or that? Like, man, I was like really close to that. And so I can understand that if they didn't have a support system, if they didn't have the medication to, you know, to put serotonin back in their brains, a chemical imbalance in your brain, like if they didn't have those things, or if I didn't have those things, there's no telling where I'd be or what I'd be doing. So the biggest thing that I got out of it was judgment, like not judging people why they do things, you know, understanding that everyone is dealing with something, probably, you know, like everyone has their own issues and their own things that they're dealing with, and internally and mental, on the mental side of it, and mental health specifically, you can't see it. It's an injury. I feel like brain is part of your body. They call it mental health, but it should be physical, in my opinion, because it's part of your brain and part of, you know, and you, it's something that you can't see. And if any other injury that we had competing, you know, let's say it's an ankle or something, like you could see us limping, you know, like you could see us, you know, we broke our arm, we're in a sling, like, oh yeah, that guy's got a broken arm. But in it, you know, like the mental health side of it, that guy's really depressed, or that woman is, you know, really struggling with her anxiety or something like that. We can't see that. And so the biggest thing that I got out of it, honestly, was trying to be as non-judgmental as I could, because there's just no telling what people are dealing with.
What would be your advice, or what has been the thing for you to kind of win each day and continue to improve mentally? What advice would you give to someone that also is like, yes, this all feels like me?
I'd say be open and vulnerable. Like, just like, it's okay. I said it a few times in the documentary. It's okay to not be okay. Like, it's okay. Like, it's gonna be okay. And I think, you know, as you see people that you look up to, it could be athletes, could be, you know, your boss, it could be anyone, right? Like, if they come out and they say, you know, I, you know, recently again, I said I'm a big combat sports fan, and like Tyson Fury comes out. He's the heavyweight champion, boxing heavyweight champion of the world, like one of the baddest dudes on the planet. He was heavily depressed, suicidal, is what he says. If someone like that can come out and say and be that vulnerable and say like this, I was in this kind of spot and these were my thoughts and these were my feelings. You can too, because he's a tough dude. And so if you see Naomi Osaka or Simone Biles or Max Crosby or Kevin Love or obviously Michael Phelps, you know, our buddy down at El Dorado.
They
can come out and say that kind of stuff. You know, he's the greatest Olympian of all time, Phelps, and he can come out. We have private conversations all the time. Just how you doing, man? Like, how you feeling? Call me if you need anything, like that kind of stuff. Call me if you want to talk. And you just be open, be vulnerable with loved ones, because I promise you that they're probably dealing with something similar as well. The true moment when I was that was really eye opening for me early on was finding out how many people just in the United States deal with mental health issues. It tens of millions of people, and like it's more than 50%, you know, and so. That's a lot of people that are dealing with this similar issues that are trying to find ways to combat it, ways to get their mind out of it, change the channel on your negative thoughts and all that stuff. Been through a million things and ways to do it, ways to get out of it and stuff. And it's okay. Like I'm totally fine being vulnerable on a podcast that we don't know how many people are going to watch this, people I've never met before, and I'm okay with it. And I'm telling everyone else that they should be too.
Yeah. I was the same way. As soon as I started opening up to my wife and talking to her about just, you know, what I'm going through for so long, I just internalized everything. And it just was, everything just seemed so daunting every day. So many different thoughts, but everything you've spoke about are things that I've dealt with, and it's never easy, but you know, there's ways to get through it. And I've found that breathing has worked really well for me. Just meditation, positive affirmations. And, that's been kind of the key for me. And honestly, stepping away from golf, man, like getting into broadcasting and finding success in something else. It's been great for my golf too. Now I go play golf, have fun. And, I don't quite have that performance anxiety anymore that I used to have, where I cared about what people think and, constantly worrying about what people are saying on social media. It's just not the same anymore. And I know so many people go through that day in and day out with their, whether it's school, business, and sports, and it's tough. Social media makes it can be a very fun place and a very terrible place. And that's kind of our culture that we live in right now. It's a compared culture, and it can definitely tear you down more than it builds you up sometimes.
Yeah. And you came up in an era too, and with the friends that you guys that you hung out with, where they had a lot of success, right? Like Jordan, oh, yeah. JT and Ricky had a lot of success, and so did you, but like, mm-hmm. The four of you had so much success that, that if one of you were to drop off a little bit, it would probably feel really lonely. Right. And, you know, you sort of equate it to like, and I'm always aware of, you know, people kind of around you that you care about that don't get as much attention as you do because you were a professional golfer or I was a professional tennis player, right? Like I'm very cognizant of like my sister, you know, like my sister who I love to death, grew up, you know, 15 months apart. She played tennis. She was actually ranked higher than me when we were 12 and 14 years old. Like she was a really good player, went to Florida State to play on a full scholarship, played college tennis. And so she was a really good player. But she wasn't going to be as good as I was, you know, and I was always aware of that. And trying to make sure that you know, she was included in things and tennis things. And we talked about her when we talked about tennis in our family, as opposed to it was just me. And so I can imagine that watching, because you want the same, like Andy Roddick, again, was like the alpha male of our generation. Andy and I were really close. We were like brothers, but I wanted the same success, or like I wanted more success, but I wanted him to have success too. Mm-hmm. That meant when he had success, that meant like, well, shit, I beat him in practice, so why can't I do that? He won the US Open when he was 20 years old in 2003. Like, I beat him like the week before. Why couldn't I win the US Open? You know, so like that was, so I loved that when he did, when he was successful with that stuff. But when he was successful and I wasn't successful, that was when it was tough, right? Like that was when it was like, man, I'm getting lapped by my friend here. And like, I need to, and that's honest truth. I didn't want him to not have success. I just wanted to have as much or more success.
And this kind of goes in that same conversation talking about the US Open, Andy Roddick winning, but with major championships, you know, a lot of times athletes struggle with how to prepare for a major championship. And I see that so often in the game of golf, that certain players just once the majors come around, it just the practice, the intensity, there's just so much. It's like the weight of the world is on their shoulders. Did you experience that much for majors? And I'm curious too. And when it comes to golf, do you think it's better to honestly do less before a major championship, or like get it to where it's so good, you're like, okay, I'm so confident. And when you show up to a major.
Yeah. Again, this is another time where golf and tennis are similar, but the exact opposite, I feel like. So intent, we have four majors, just like you guys do. They're by far the biggest tournaments of the year. There's no other tournaments that we'd like to win other than the Grand Slams. There's probably eight guys, like, honestly, like if you got them in a room and closed the door and said, do you honestly think you can win this tournament? There's probably 6 to 8 guys. In the US Open coming up down the street in LA Country Club, there's probably 100 guys, maybe not that many, maybe 50 guys that truly believe they can win the US Open and like could, like, you know, because golf is like it's in tennis, the best player wins a lot. In golf, the best player doesn't win all the time. It's really hard to play really good all the time in golf. It's easier to play bad in tennis and win by far than it is in golf, because we're only beating
one guy. Yeah.
It's just one guy that day. And if we don't, we go home. And if we do, we move on to the next one, obviously. So like it's, I can honestly say there were two majors that I genuinely thought I could win the tournament. Only two. And I was, you know, I was a really good player, and as high as, you know, that came out ugly. I thought I was a really good player, and I was in the, you know, again, like top eight in the world for a while. And like two majors that I thought I was going to do: 2011 Wimbledon, 2011 US Open. Truly the 2011 US Open, I felt like was my year. I can win this tournament. I genuinely thought I could win the tournament. Now, looking back, I had to go through Tsonga in the fourth round, Djokovic in the quarters, Murray in the semis, and either Nadal or Federer in the final. So it's going to be pretty difficult to do that. Yeah, it was going to be pretty difficult to do that. But internally, genuinely thought that. Like, the PGA was just played, and like, you know, we've seen a lot of random champions win the PGA championship before. And there's a lot more guys in golf that can win on a weekly basis than there are in tennis.
We'll kind of end on this. And you're a guy who lives in LA, adopted hometown now, and LACC is going to be the site of the US Open. I know you play your golf at Bel Air, correct?
Bel Air and Hillcrest. Yeah.
What's your overall impressions of LACC? I'm sure you played there a time or two. What are these guys going to expect? What are the fans expect? It looks amazing. I played it once, and to me, it's going to be a fantastic venue.
I've played it a bunch. I love the course. I almost said track. I can't stand when someone called it a track.
I do it all the time, man.
I love the North Course. Riviera Country Club is, Riviera is my favorite golf course in the world that I've ever played. I feel like every shot is on purpose. LA Country Club, LA North is right behind that, in my opinion. I feel like every hole and every shot is there for a reason. You hit, you know, driver off. Well, the only issue with LA Country Club is you can kind of carry around your driver, you know, like Riviera, the first four holes, you hit three different clubs.
Yeah.
You know, and I love that type of golf. So what they're going to find is, some really cool holes, some really like interesting holes. 15 is a par three. That's like a really short par three. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah. But it's like angled, like diagonally, correct. Real skinny, shallow green.
The green kind of reminds you of Riviera number 10 green, where it's like that sort of narrow. But it's like sort of up the chute. So if you laid up on 10 at Riv and then you had that sort of straight shot about 100 yards or 80 yards or whatever it is, that's that type of hole. It's really short. Guys are going to flip little wedges and stuff into it, but man, is it going to be a cool hole at the end of like a round or the end of a tournament? I don't know where they're going to put the tee box. I don't know where they're going to put some of these tee boxes. There's some,
it's, you
know,
just flip wedge there, I think. And there's some holes too that play like 300 yards for a par three. So they got an interesting mix of holes.
Number 11 is a par three. I was just going to say that's like, you know, 270 yards kind of thing. It's downhill, but it's a beautiful view of like downtown LA, and, you know, it's gorgeous. But they, yeah, I mean, there's some beast holes out there. Some really hard par fours, some, and into like short par fours that have like crazy second shots or like drivable par fours. And if you remember, number six is like a,
it's like blind shot over the right, correct?
Blind shot, drivable par four. And if you lay up, you again have this like tiny green to hit in and like a 40 yard flip shot. So it's like, it's going to be, and then the next hole is like a 280 yard par three. Like almost the same distance, par three. So it's like,
That's crazy.
It's a fascinating course. I can't wait. I'm going to go out there and watch in person. I'm going to watch a ton on TV. I can't wait. I love major championship golf, and especially love when you guys get your ass kicked. I love those. when you guys are struggling and the course is hard, for us hacks, man, it makes us feel better. I don't know why, but it makes
us as long as it's fair.
I want a plus an over par winner. I love those. I really do. I don't know if the LA Country Club, LA North is going to give you that, but the US Open has always been, you know, Masters and the US Open have been my two favorites that I watch, because usually it takes a different style of player to win the US Open or to win the British Open. And it's similar in tennis, right? Like the French Open is going on right now on clay, and then they'll play on grass. And like, it's a different type of player that's going to win those, you know, those tournaments, or a different style of play that you have to play to win those tournaments. And I feel like the PGA is usually a, you know, how deep can you go? And then the US Open is like, how hard is it going to be? And so I hope they make it hard. Cause I love watching them and I love watching them kind of suffer from time to time. Cause they're so good. It's so good.
I know.
I'll text Justin one time. I'm like, dude, how did you shoot 64 at Riviera? I don't even understand how it's possible. And he's like, dude, if it's not windy or anything, like, it just doesn't matter. And I'm just like, screw you, dude.
I mean, these guys are good. Well, with all that being said, and you've seen LACC a couple different times, do you have a player in mind that you like for the US Open? That you want to go out ahead of time and say, this is my guy?
US Opens, obviously, you always have to drive the ball well. Look, the two guys that I bet every major, whether they're playing or not, is Ricky and Xander. I just feel like they have to win a major. Like, I just feel like they do. So I automatically take both of those guys.
Okay.
And then I don't know, I feel like, you know, again, there's 30 guys that are playing phenomenal golf that like could very easily win. It could be, you know, US Open. We've seen guys that don't necessarily putt well, but can ball strike it like crazy and just put it on the green and two putt a lot. I mean, that's a big thing in US Open, you know, US Open type golf. So I'm super excited for it. I have no idea. I hope one of my buddies wins. I don't care if they're on the LIV or the PGA Tour at all. I just want to watch it. I love the drama. I want to watch it. I want to see them suffer sometimes, not always, sometimes. And it's going to be a blast to watch. So I'll go with, I don't know, I mentioned it a couple of times. We'll go with Justin Thomas.
Okay, there it is, folks. Justin Thomas, the US Open champion at LACC. Well, I'm gonna be out there that week calling golf for NBC Golf, or excuse me, NBC Sports. So please come say hello. I'll have the headset on, but make sure that you don't be a stranger. And as always, man, this was really fun. I feel like we hit it all. We hit golf. We hit you know, the mental issues that come with being an athlete. And Marty, thank you for coming on. It was really fun to talk, and I know a lot of people are gonna really enjoy this.
Thanks for having me, buddy. I appreciate it. I know it's been a star-studded list that you've had. So to drop down to me was
kind of
a bummer, I'm sure, for you.
Stop it, man. But, you're the man.
thank you for having me, and I'll see you in L.A., baby.
All right, brother. Thanks for coming on. Loved catching up with Marty Fish. I am so appreciative of the way he shared. Having the courage to speak about that in public is not only relatable to others, it continues to remove the stigma around mental health issues. Make sure you are subscribed to the feed, because we will be back here early next week recapping the 123rd US Open. Thanks for listening, and see you then. The Smiley Show is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please give a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe today wherever you stream your podcast.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.